Okay, this is Cameron and Bob for our 19th session, discussing thoughts and patterns around my new pamphlet on Donald Trump. It came out a few months ago. So, Cameron, you wanted to get into an article you did called The Technique of Flight, before we finally tackle my book.
Correct.
And that was written, I look at the bottom, February 15th.
February 15th.
Pretty recent.
Right.
Okay, what did you want to say about it?
Well, in your book, as an introduction to your take on Trump, what you do is discuss McLuhan in a way that you think is not common, and you think that you put forward the idea that if McLuhan is read in a new way with attention to quotations that are generally not used in McLuhan research, that provides kind of lens or a kind of foundation to get into your take on Trump. So in order to sort of set the table for that discussion, I think that the technique of flight gives a good overview of my take on McLuhan, and that will guide me in my discussion with you about your take on McLuhan.
Okay.
And I think what we might do is look at the bottom quotation from McLuhan in 1961. We can see the heart of the matter. Do you mind if I read a little bit of this quotation from McLuhan?
No. It's a very important article, The Humanities in the Electronic Age.
Correct. One of McLuhan's bulletins to Canada, I would call it. This was first printed in the bulletin of the Humanities Association of Canada.
Yeah.
And I believe that McLuhan often took special care in his broadcasts to the Canadian nation, you might say.
Yeah, you suggest that he... any major announcement, like the medium is a message, you would first do in Canada.
That's correct. The Global Village is another example.
Yeah, that's a good note. Good noticing there.
So what he says here is that Bertrand Russell pointed to the great achievement of the 20th century as the technique of suspended judgment. And, of course, he very often quotes Russell's ABC of relativity. So what he has in mind here physics of relativity, the physics of the uncertainty principle.
Yes.
So he says, that is, it made the discovery of the process of insight itself, the technique of avoiding automatic closure or involuntary fixing of attitudes that so easily results from any given individual or cultural situation. The discovery of the technique of open field perception, the technique of insight itself. Then he goes on to say, this is the means of abstracting oneself from the bias and consequence of one's own individual and social culture, the technique of suspended judgment, the technique of how not to have a point of view. So the whole question is, how is it possible for humans not to have a point of view? The general way of thinking about how humans experience individually and collectively is to relate that experience to assumptions that are either conscious or unconscious. And a huge amount of research has been done in that way. But here's McLuhan saying that it's possible to exercise a technique of not to have a point of view. That's very interesting. Now, down in the comments on footnote number 7, I contrast Caspar David Friedrich's Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog, which is an 1818 painting. And in this painting, Friedrich presents a wanderer who's at the tip of a mountain, and the wanderer looks out over a sea of cloud and fog that prevents any sort of view of what's below, but gives a tremendous view of what's out in front of him and above him. And what we might see in this picture is how the wanderer has achieved a point of view that is not the point of view of the people that are down below, the people that have no relation to him because of the fog and the clouds that are between the individual wanderer and all of the people below. So the wanderer has achieved a point of view that is special and that needs to be marked. And when McLuhan talks about the closure of experience, what he's talking about is the romantic attempt to define moments of experience that are revelatory. Right? So the time is stopped, space is stopped, and the revelatory experience is framed by this stoppage. So then the same footnote, number 7, goes on to talk about the portrait by Juan Gris in 1916. So almost exactly 100 years later, his portrait of Josette, who I believe was his niece. But in the portrait of Josette, which is a Cubist portrait, both the person being painted and the painter have become destabilized. And there is no point of view that is emphasized or valorized or stabilized. It's a Cubist picture where different angles on the face and body of Josette are set forth in a contemporary or instantaneous view, and that view or views, properly plural, not only destabilizes Josette, it also destabilizes the painter. And so the contrast between these two pictures shows what has happened to the privilege of the point of view over the 100 years between 1818 and 1916. And even the First World War might be seen as the destruction and end of the individual point of view, because the war killed indiscriminately huge numbers of people from all the powers of Europe, killed off the flower of England and Scotland and Germany and France in a way that people just found staggering. They were unable to come to grips with the inconsequence of the individual in the face of poisonous gas and in the face of tanks. So the what happens in over that period, as Russell says, is that judgment becomes suspended. That is to say, judgment no longer has an anchor in some frame that the individual is able to construct. So a new way of being a human experiencing as a human had to be found, and it's here we are 100 years after the First World War and after the portrait by Juan Gris, and we still don't have an answer to that.
Right.
In my view, the great contribution of McLuhan is that he saw the problem and attempted to answer it, and we so far have not been able to read him in that light.
Right.
And I think that's the great failing of McLuhan research, that here was McLuhan attempting to make a world-altering suggestion, proposal, and it's basically been ignored.
Mm. Yeah.
So what he says is the what's needed to go from the romantic fixture on an object, and notice when the romantic fixes on an object in a certain moment of time, that fixes the experience of the individual. It fixes the experience of the individual in the artwork. It could be a poem, a novel, a painting, whatever. But it also fixes the personality of the artist. So there's a kind of a double fixation that goes on. And then both of those become loosened in a way that is very interesting, was dreadful for the history of the world, and now begs for an answer. And what?
Okay, hold it. What did you say? What were the two things that became loosened or lucid?
No, loosed.
Loosed. And what? Say the two again. I missed that.
The one is the experience within the painting or the poem or the novel, that becomes loose, and probably Finnegan's Wake is a great example of that, but even Ulysses. And the second thing is the artist, him or herself, that does the painting, does the poem, does the novel. Their personality in the romantic moment is fixed, just like what they're putting in the artwork. And 100 years later, both the personality within the artwork and the personality doing the artwork, those both become exploded, one could say.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be Finnegan's Wake, too?
Absolutely. That's what I just was saying. Yeah.
Well, the first part... He said in the first case, the subject of the work was...
That's right. So
yeah.
In Finnegan's Wake, and here I don't have anything like your expertise in it, but not only is HCE multiple, as the very name says, but then all of the characters blend into each other in various ways.
Right.
The characters blend into one another, and the geography blends in with the characters, and so there's a kind of a multiple explosion and implosion going on, and the artist in presenting this has to have experienced something like that internally in order to make the object of correlative.
Yeah. I want to mention you don't have the explosion or the simultaneity or the multiple levels in romantic painting, but it's a bit of a retrieval of the primitive because they bring in discontinuity. So the romantics move out of the straightforward prose of the Pope, Alexander Pope, and maybe that era, and the couplet. But now you have discontinuity. So there's the beginning, you could say, of the electric, if you say the movie is an electric technology. I think McLuhan considered it a combination of mechanical and electric. But he makes a big deal about these romantic poets anticipating the cinematic aesthetic, well, anticipating cinema with what he calls the aesthetic moment. So that part of electricity, different from print, is discontinuity, and so that's the beginning of the electric age sneaking in to the radical romantics. So they're not just trying to retrieve nature, which was a product of the book, and the alphabet. They are also intuiting something that's coming in the 19th century, because they're at the beginning. It's discontinuity. Yep. So there's the difference.
Very good point. So you could what you could do is you could think of a series of paintings by the Romantics, and the discontinuity between them is something that they can't build into the picture, but the pictures taken together are an example of that.
Yeah.
And not only are they an example of that, but if you panned over this series of romantic pictures, basically you'd have film.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so you're exactly right that when humans do something, there's always multiple levels of time and space going on, regardless of whether they are aware of it.
Yeah, there's always the past, the present, and the future.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But that's horizontal time. There's also vertical time going on. And the when artists are producing their work and trying to decide what should I show and how should I show it, McLuhan says they are exemplary for feeling out these coming environments.
Yep, exactly. The just thinking about the vertical. So the Romantics run to nature. They're fed up with the industry and the beginning of cities or industrial cities. So were they taking a vertical flight by plunging into the Lake District or nature or revolution?
Well, remember that the Wordsworth and Coleridge and those people are not too affected yet by industry. Industry is certainly starting, but it's going to be another 30 or 40 years before it really explodes with the railways and with the development of the manufacturing cities in the Midlands. You're right to say that they intuit that the ground beneath their feet is shifting.
Yeah.
And they're trying to find a way of dealing with that. And McLuhan can be seen as Joyce can be seen, or Eliot can be seen as 150 years after that, radically experiencing these earthquakes and trying to find out if it's possible to have a posture anymore.
You're right. And it's in that 50 years coming up, that'll be the beginning. McLuhan likes to say 1830, but maybe more 1850 with the telegraph. You have the beginning of the hardware communist environment. Hardware communal services, before Marx showed up.
Sure. Well, that's very much related to the short conversation we had before we started recording. and that is that the Canadian Confederation was in large part a result of the need for social investment that the geography of Canada made very difficult to achieve through individuals, and therefore had to be made through some sort of social contribution to infrastructure. And that's what McLuhan saw Marx as kind of riding that social infrastructure wave into the future.
Yeah.
Who was going to control it, and how would that work?
Yeah, and that would be a rupture to the sense of the literate individual. You know, the retrieved tribal starting to happen, and that would threaten the
Correct.
Values of Wordsworth and the guys before them.
Yeah, so
yeah.
What you're talking about there is exactly what I tried to describe in terms of the contrast between the Friedrich painting and the Juan Gris painting.
Right.
That you have individuality that is kind of enforced, right? The romantic artist, according to McLuhan, can be seen as specifying the aesthetic moment. And there's a kind of force involved in that because that moment is divorced from other moments of the artist's life, but also the moments of the experience of other people. And then below that, the total spectrum of possible experience.
Yeah.
And so the 20th century is going to represent a kind of continuing descent through those levels of experience.
Yeah, the destabilizing of the subject.
Correct.
in the
Absolutely.
20th century.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
The attempt to maintain the individual fixed perspective, the forcible attempt to ward off
Correct.
These multiple instabilities is the romantic character.
Correct.
And
and the really interesting thing in McLuhan is if it's possible to have what he calls the technique of how not to have a point of view, the question is, how can that not be the further violent imposition of the individual on experience? Right? How can it be that you have a technique that is not a romantic stabilization?
Mm. Yeah, what is that?
Right? That's a very interesting question. Pardon me?
What is that? How do you...
Well, that's right. So, I mean, that's one of the questions posed by Joyce in his novels, right? How can you have a technique of not having a point of view that is not somehow a reflection of the individual? How can the artist give up his or her individuality and yet still produce a work?
Yeah, so makes me remember what McLuhan said about Mallarmé and the symbolists. They took the language, the means for expressing a point of view, the language itself as an object.
Correct, correct. Not only as an object, as a subject.
Yeah, the subject, right.
Yeah,
yep.
So, yeah, and that is going to be the McLuhan's answer to this question of the technique of how not to have a point of view, is that if the artist or the theoretician, the theoretician of media, let's say, if they take their stance on the spectrum of possibilities, then, number one, they admit that they willy-nilly are exercising one possibility, but number two, that possibility and all of the experience that they're looking at in their either individual work or in their book or in their film, all of that is also an expression of possibility. And so what you have on both the subject and the object is attention to the inherent possibilities of every mode of experience.
And expression, or the media,
yeah.
Mode of media.
Right. So medium, the media as the spectrum of possibilities. And what that means is you never can say anything without having regard to the possibilities of what you might have said instead, and you can never say anything about other people that doesn't look at the possibilities of what they might have said instead.
Mm.
So everything comes down to this kind of spectrum of possibilities, and I liken it oftentimes in my blog to a kind of piano that gets played. And the different notes constitute identity, constitute the form of experience. And the great question is, who plays the piano?
Hmm.
And it's a kind of nobody.
Right.
So the nobody that plays the piano is kind of the answer that McLuhan and others in the 20th century come up with as the answer to what is human identity.
I mean, did you say they come up with the answer, nobody is the answer? Is that what you just
That's
said?
Right. This nobody in the no man's land where the piano is played is the notion they have of human identity.
Yeah.
And it's one that, for example, when Eliot, in his early essay on the individual talent, talks about the complete change of the history of any field when a new meaningful work is put into it, that's how human experience works, that they, from note to note on the piano, the piano of experience, everything changes. All past, all future, and trying to understand how that works and what it means is the great task for the 20th and 21st centuries.
Yeah, are you thinking of that quote from Eliot, were you talking about a new series performance affects everything in the past, back to Homer, say, if it's in writing? Is that what you were thinking
Correct.
Of?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Two things on the nobody. When Zappa had one of his first interviews in the New York Times in 1966, they were playing in a New York club there and getting attention. He says, nobody knows who the drummer is in the band. Nobody knows which instrument is the drummer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They didn't know who was playing what. There was a drummer and guitarist and that. But in the end, the rhythm, they weren't sure if it was run by the drummer. If it was, they didn't know which instrument was the drummer or playing the drummer role.
Absolutely.
So I thought
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Because the music that was developing back then, the rhythm guitar played a very important role, right?
Yeah.
So was the rhythm coming from the drummer? Was it coming from the guitarist? Was it coming from, you know, some other instrument?
Yeah.
And, that's excellent. Contemporaneous with that, Beckett was writing his plays about nobody.
Yeah. In 1975, you know, McLuhan hit on a theme, which you hear here and there for the next 6 months in 75, was that everybody's a nobody at a ball game.
Right.
Remember that one?
Yes, sir.
Everybody becomes a nobody. Now, the Jumbotron comes in, and then the camera can focus on people. So that created Pamela Anderson, the star, or, you know, the TV star,
right.
Whatever she was. because it focused on her, and then the camera wanted to move, and the audience said, no, keep it focused on that blonde girl there, just out of high school or something. But the
right. So that's a good example of how the romantic ideal or the romantic need has not left humans.
Right.
The humans are desperate for some frame of reference. And somebody like Pamela Anderson was able to kind of mock that.
Yeah.
Right? If you know, you want to frame me, fine. I'll do anything that you want to frame, but I'm also going to be outside that frame.
Yeah, I'm going to be still a nobody.
Yeah, yeah.
So that happened the same time as the Internet started, which allowed people to hijack broadcasting and start making their own spaces, being their own publishers. So that retrieves a virtual version of the Gutenberg meme. So it's interesting that Jumbotron was a parallel retrieval like the Internet was at the same time.
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just, you say you're still in this, so let's keep talking.
Well, I mean, I think having said that, we can go on to your book.
No, but let's talk about the technique of flight. What is that? What an odd title for what we're talking about. So I think we need to talk about that.
Yeah, that's a direct quote from McLuhan.
Yeah.
He says that the Romantics could not discover the technique of flight. What's that mean? It means that between poems or between pictures painted by a Romantic artist is a gap, and that gap is actually the fundamental thing to what they're doing, but they don't know that.
Yeah.
So they take flight, but the flight is unconscious. They don't understand how the human being kind of lives in the gap from moment to moment.
Right.
And it's by exploring that gap that the that electricity is going to be discovered and applied, and the whole experience of the 19th century is going to be an attempt to come to grips with that, with the instability implied by the gap.
Right, and also in art, the Cubist view is the first product of the flight.
Well, I wouldn't say that. The Cubism is sort of very early 20th century, maybe in the, a little bit in the 1890s, but French poetry, Baudelaire and Rimbaud, is considerably ahead of that.
Right. So, but I'm saying that's an example of becoming conscious of flying in the gap?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's not, cubism is often more the question than the answer.
Mm.
Right? The and even in McLuhan, the a late work like Take Today constantly reverts to the nobody and to the gap and to the no man's land. But the... the technique of flight involved there is still unclear. And I don't, personally, I don't think that McLuhan ever came up with a good answer to what is the medium.
Hmm.
Right? He knew that the question of the medium was all important. The medium is the message. The medium is the question. The medium is the demand that we need to make on ourselves. But I don't think that he came up with a clear answer to that, which would have resulted in a science of media.
Right. So, you know the word, you ever see the word mediums? People will talk about the plural of medium as mediums.
Sure.
I take the plural as media. Is mediums accepted in some places? Maybe Americans. People who are nowhere near Toronto use the word mediums, but
yeah.
Torontonians
well,
know the word media. What is the rule on that, the grammatical?
Well, I don't think there is a grammatical rule. A whole bunch of words that are pure Latin, when they come into the English language, people really don't know how to make the plurals. So, for example, stadium, right? How many people say stadia? Very, very few, right? Stadiums is the usual word. And there's many examples of that. And
yeah.
With media and medium and mediums, the problem there is that the word medium has many different meanings, and nobody is quite sure what the different plurals signify.
Right.
Right. Usually when people talk about media, they're taking the term to mean newspapers and film and all that sort of stuff, and it really doesn't have a singular. Very few people talk about the newspaper as a medium.
Yeah.
Right? Lewis did, there are certainly examples of that, but they're fairly rare.
Of talking, of using the word medium, they don't use the
yes.
word medium? Is that what you just said?
No, what I'm saying is that the use of the singular medium to refer, let's say, to newspapers, that's something that Lewis does in American Cosmic Man, but it's not very common. Usually, when people think about media, they don't think that there's a singular behind it, medium.
That's right.
Right? They think
yes.
They think of media as itself being a sort of natural collective.
Right. So if you look at the newspaper, it's not a medium. It's the media. The media is the most pervasive new word of the 20th century, other than
maybe.
Slang, different slangs, but as a proper noun, that's why there's confusion about it, and which is natural, because Cubism, McLuhan used to say, was originally called multi-locational art, and multi-locational would be the effect of the telephone. You'd be discarded.
Well,
you'd be in two places at
yeah,
once.
Yeah, probably the telegraph more than the telephone, right? The telegraph represented an instantaneity of communication and of experience that was completely novel in the history of the world.
Yes, but it was writing. It had the I factor. The telephone has you talking intimately with someone. So they might as well be in the room with you. There's still a remoteness when you read a message in the telegraph.
Well, maybe. I think that when you say that, you're looking backwards. If you look at it in 1835, when the telegraph is new, revolutionary, never seen anything like this before in the history of the world, it's startlingly destabilizing.
Right.
Or multi-locational, as you were saying.
Right. Okay, so the flight... the overview, McLuhan says that literate man has the bird's eye view, which biases people towards the vertical school of symbolism. But the technique of flight, is that got more with the gap than the bird's eye view, if you're looking down on a landscape, flying
well,
over?
Well, I think it's both. I think McLuhan uses it both ways. And the general idea is that this kind of attitude, which can be taken up by the theoretician, is actually how all experience already works, that human beings already are taking flight between moments, and they're taking flight over the possibilities of experience, and experience can be seen as growing out of this process, but it's totally unconscious in humans, just like using the grammar of languages unconscious. And if we're going to get a new kind of stability based on this extremely unstable situation, it has to come from the consciousness of this, I guess you could say, of this fact of flight. Mm. The fact that human beings are already doing this, it's already something with the kernel of the future in it, if we're going to have a future. But it needs to. We need to isolate the fundamental forms or the fundamental structures that are in play here, and that's the medium that is the message.
Right. So he pointed out that the movie was a mixture of the mechanical and electric. So the eye and the ear. It was a means of flight through the kinetic aspects of the movie. And it was the final container. And he said the movie contained all other media.
Yep.
Then you get into radio and TV, which is pure process of circuitry. So the cinema it completes the Gutenberg galaxy.
Right.
Yeah, and the aesthetic moment.
It represents, not only does it complete it, but it represents an attempt to get back to it, an attempt to sort of put it into concrete.
Yeah.
So you can see you can see today with all of the crap that Netflix and Amazon Prime and HBO produce as movies. They're called movies, but really it's just junk that can be thrown together in an attempt to fixate viewers' attention.
Yeah, to re-instigate the meme of individuality or individual
Correct.
Subjectivity.
Yeah, get back to the Gutenberg galaxy, absolutely.
Yeah, and so that's what America is, you know.
Correct.
Movies
Correct.
And rock and roll, kinetic
right.
and the literate individual, but mechanized or going
yep.
through hardware industry, so... The,
Correct,
the,
and
yeah.
I assume that that's getting close to let's say close to a springboard for your book.
Yeah. Let's see. What you know on page 136 of Cliched Archetype. He talks about this eight examples of national plenary awareness, a phrase that gives a sense of mastery. I was wondering what it would be in Canada. Is there a phrase that gives a sense of what he called plenary awareness in Canadian culture? And what would
hockey
be...
Hockey night in Canada.
Okay. What would be the sensory bias? I brought this up in a talk in 2001, July 2001, when I was visiting Halifax, and I was reading some Air Canada magazine on the way from New York to Halifax, and it gave me all these ideas about fashions and that, some different articles in there. But I came up with... Now, you might know this, but you weren't in the state. You were in the States, too. But there was some kind of ad for beer that people decided to slogan on it. You know, I am one or I am important or something. Do you remember that Canadian commercial or beer commercial?
I don't, but
okay.
I find it easy to imagine.
Right. So if anybody remembers it, I decided that was the expression for Canadian quadriphenia. Canadians were quadriphenic because they were the borderline case. They were up against a whole bunch of different cultures and territories. You know how McLuhan talked about that?
Sure.
And so they, in a way, didn't have one sensory preference. They would hop from one to another in a low dimension, a low, what's that word, low definition aspect.
Yep.
So I was making up this whole theory about the Canadian culture, and people, I asked the audience, well, what phrase in your culture is symptomatic of this, what I'm describing as quadriphenia? And a couple people came up with that commercial. So I'll have to go back and look at the tape and see what that phrase was, see if I can remember it. But just wondering but you weren't in Canada in that period. You had lost your locality. You were an American for years, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I had at that point in time, I'd been largely in the States for about 20 years.
Right.
Although I was, my most of my family was still in Canada, and I was going back to visit once or twice a year.
Right. Now, so people, McLuhan and Gutenberg Galaxy talks about the verbal versus the pictorial. So on the surface, the movie seems a threat to book culture. And sure, teachers in the 20s probably worried that kids were watching too much movies, right? Watching too many movies and losing their literacy. So that's what's so unique about McLuhan saying, no, no, movies ain't anti-literacy. They're the completion of literacy of the Gutenberg Galaxy. Boy, that would have been a hard one for people to get if they actually knew he said it back
right,
in the 50s.
Right. But let me just go back for a minute. When you were talking about sort of the instability of identity in Canada and how everything was low res compared to American high res. The for McLuhan, what's interesting about Canada and what kind of enthused him about being a Canadian is that the Canada, because of its low-res experience, is a kind of picture of how experience works. So the all experience, you could say, is Canadian. But what is American is the attempt to fixate experiences. As we were saying before about the Jumbotron, what happens in the United States is that the experience which is low res and which doesn't feel right because it's fluid and it's not we are number one, that kind of low-res experience gets highlighted, gets iconized in American culture. And that tension between low and high-res is still very much going on. And I would be very surprised if it doesn't play a big role in your pamphlet.
Right. And did you say that the epiphany of we're number one, is that what you're saying is the American preference, the American archetype?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. It's an attempt to get back to the Gutenberg Galaxy or an attempt to pour the foundations of the Gutenberg Galaxy into the world, into a world that's inherently dynamic and can't be concretized. Fundamental difference between Canadians and Americans is that Americans simply cannot let go of being number one, cannot let go of having experience that is fixated, whereas Canadians never had that and are uncomfortable with that, find it strange and constraining and just hard to believe.
Yeah. I was thinking that the aesthetic moment that probably peaked with the Beatniks going on the road and having some epiphany, some archetypal meaningful experience, that would be trying to get a fix on things in a liquid situation.
Sure.
Find the one that's
still
the mountain.
Absolutely, but look at what's going on now with the cancel culture, right? The cancel culture is simply the idea that a single dogma can be concretized as true, and you need to salute it, obey it, further it as the meaning of life. And all American universities have been Gleichschaltet, right? That was the Nazi word for getting everything to be the same, right? That's
yes.
Now happening in American culture. So the media, the universities, the Congress, everybody is attempting to signal their need for one dimensionality. And of course, it's creating huge problems because let's say you have one idea about immigration. And that one idea is that if immigration is not purely white, then it's good. Then you end up with a situation on the border that on the one hand has dogma and on the other hand has reality, and nobody knows how to fix that.
Yeah. I had a thought there. The the archetype of the individual epiphany, that was the transcendentalist. This is why McLuhan, you know, set himself up in the ancient quarrel against the transcendentalist, the Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson school. And McLuhan, would you say that Thomism, Aquinas' philosophy or doctrine, was multifaceted, not subject to the effect of the printed book?
Well, that's certainly what McLuhan often wrote.
Yeah.
When he wrote about the affinities between Joyce and Aquinas, what he was saying is that for both of them, the labyrinth is a kind of master image, and the labyrinth is the confrontation with different points of view where if there can be a weighting, weight, W-E-I-G-H, if there can be a weighting or a proper emphasis on those different points of view, it can't be because one of them is privileged. Instead, it has to be something like the procedure of Thomas, where the various objections are listed, and then they are taken up in their own terms. Right? So that's very similar to what we were saying earlier about the piano of experience, or about the possibilities of experience that lie vertically below all experience.
Yes. Again, another idea escapes me for a second. Let me think. The so I'm thinking about the Canadian character. In general, though, Canadians and Americans go out to be alone because they both grew up in the wilderness. So Canada is not extremely, you know, obviously un-American. It's these subtleties we're talking about between the Canadian and the American. And maybe it's more obvious to other parts of the world. You know, they talk about Canadians being very different from Americans. But among ourselves, we don't see it as much between Canadians and Americans. So McLuhan defines the American as not visual. He's kinetic manipulatory, so that's industry, whereas the British are visually biased. I know it like the back of my hand. So the kinetic plus visual part of America leads to the paradox that they're always inventing new environments that undermine their treasured, literate, individualist, visual bias origins or archetype.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're always undermining themselves.
Right. But that's sort of the case with all experience. When you could say that that's one of the insights of American Cosmic Man, is that America presents a kind of speed-up portrait of everybody. So in that
in the world, every culture in the world? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, of individual experience. You're talking about America inventing things that undermines what it was. Well, all experience is like that. That's what it means to grow up. That's what it means to become educated. That's what it means to learn a language when you're an infant. Growing up means to destabilize what you were. And the American answer to that destabilization, which is inherent to all experience, it's inherent to being a human being. The American response to that is twofold. One is, as you're saying, to invent new things that even more destabilize.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's the demand for stabilization. Right? And it's that contrast that really defines the United States. Canada, in comparison, is much slower. Canadians are much more content with where they are, where they were, compared to Americans.
Yeah.
But let me just, if I can,
yeah.
I want to go back to this whole idea of going out to be alone, because that actually recaptures what we've talked about from start to finish. Because going out to be alone from McLuhan has been misunderstood. People think that he's thinking about, you go out and only go out to be alone, but how can you go to a restaurant where there's all these people? How can you go to a concert where there's all these people, or a hockey game or something? And it doesn't make sense to people, and so they repeat it, but they have no idea what McLuhan was talking about. But I think what McLuhan was talking about is, how do you go out from yourself? How do you express yourself? And the idea of going out to be alone means that the constellation of personality comes only from inside. So you go out from yourself. Of course, you're with other people. And the question arises, how much influence, how much input is there from those people on your identity? And McLuhan's idea is that Americans and Canadians, too, but to a lesser extent, the Canadians and Americans go out to be alone in the sense that they define who they are from the inside and don't allow input from the outside. And he says that's completely different in every other culture of the world. And of course, he's right. And it means that in international relations, for example, Americans find it very, very difficult even to begin to understand other cultures, because that would mean that they weren't going out of themselves to be alone.
Mm.
It would mean that there was input coming from the outside, and that's prohibited by their idea of who they are.
Right, and I think you're right that they make new technologies to retrieve the individual, and that's capitalism. You're always, like, why did radio, you know, in the 20s and 30s become commercialized? Sarnoff, McLuhan writes about him, it always has to be put back into private ownership. So capitalism is Americanism, in a way.
Right.
And
absolutely.
So they figure, when they make the when they made Web 1.0, the whole game was, okay, how do we turn this back into the individual, the virtual patina of individuality? So they went into pay internet, then Facebook and those guys took over.
Right.
And nobody knows why they took over, how did this happen? But that's the reason. You're going to always individualize increasingly complex and collective media back into the individual archetype, even though it's never retrieved completely.
Right. So the we're like two people that are circling a drain. We keep coming back to the same place. We had briefly talked about the difference between red and blue Toryism.
Right.
And what you're saying is that the United States has always been dominated by blue Toryism, that is to say a conservatism that distrusts social action, distrusts
the collective.
Any kind of inner... Sorry?
They distrust the collective.
Correct.
And that leads to the Lone Ranger, and the the Savior who rides off into the sunset by himself or herself.
Right.
Yeah,
they can't help noting that stranger who's sort of the answer to American individuality is also a nobody. Right? So they have to have the mask on him, or Superman has to be Clark Kent, and nobody knows the relationship between the two of them.
Right.
Batman has to be Bruce Wayne, and nobody knows the relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, so I was thinking, okay, that makes me think that the present mass culture is everybody attempting to be nobody to get a kind of conformity, uniformity, or consensus in a frightening situation.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody goes, because there's lots of scientific data that the masks don't work. So why do people prefer it? Well, in America, they prefer it because it reduces everybody to nobody again, which people have to suppress their individual ambitions for any kind of collective action in America. Remember, they didn't go communist in the 30s. They just were fellow travelers, and that brought in welfare.
Yeah, so this is, I think Americans are quite conscious of this duality. You can find it with Homer Simpson, and right where on the one hand, people want to be individuals. They want to be themselves, right? Be yourself. I'm me, and all this sort of stuff. But on the other hand, everybody's the same.
Yeah.
Right? And needs to be the same for economics.
Yes.
It needs to be the same for legal regulations and all that sort of stuff, right? So, yeah, this is a big problem. Notice how with masks, it's not only a signal of the nobody, it's also a signal of the somebody. And who's the somebody? The somebody is somebody who has discovered the singularity of individuality and the singularity of thinking right? So you people wear the mask not because of COVID or something. It's a sign that they have discovered the truth, that they know the proper culture, the proper stance that everybody should have.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's where we're at. So and it's quite frightening because underneath everybody's feet, the earthquakes are much more frequent and much more devastating. And the response to that is to pile more and more cement on top of it. It's like people that are trying to stop ocean erosion.
Mm.
And they're putting up concrete barriers to try to define what's ours and what belongs to the ocean. And the ocean just comes along every few years and destroys it. That's our situation now.
Right. Now, as a Canadian in the States who's put on a surface Americanism, Are you able to talk to any American about what we're talking about, the difference between Canadians or anybody and Americans? Do you ever have a conversation with anybody about
no.
that?
No. Usually when you speak to Americans about something like this, their eyes kind of glaze over.
Yeah.
It's just not a topic that interests them. They think it's a kind of a provincial concern. It's like a midget trying to talk about dunking a basketball to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
So McLuhan says that the reason Westerners don't investigate the effects of media is it's an invasion of privacy. So privacy is a big issue in America, so to talk this way is an invasion of privacy or a rudeness to talk
right.
about the effects of the environment.
Correct.
Americans.
Notice how that's exactly what I was trying to say a minute ago about going out to be alone.
Yeah.
Right? Privacy is the notion that you go out of yourself, you express yourself, you live in a social environment, all of those things you can't help. But when you find yourself in that situation, your identity needs to be private. That is to say, only comes from you.
Right. Okay.
Which is, if you think of language, think of how stupid that is in terms of language.
Yeah.
You have to use language, but language has nothing to do with you.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go over to the book and see
okay.
what I attempted to reveal.
All right. Let me get your book up here. But
yeah.
You can keep talking as I get it.
So this book is called What We/You Didn't Know About Trump.
Correct.
Now, people might think, well, there's no more Trump right now. No, Trump's still around. And he's going to make this new TV platform or information platform. That's his next invasion of people. So I'm going to, I'm looking at the opening pages, and we did the first couple of quotes, I think, because we got into cul-de-sac, but I'll let you, I don't know what to say, I have to see what you say. What does McLuhan say? I don't know what I think until I say it. So I don't know what I think until you speak.
All right, I'm still trying to
bring it up.
Your book. I may have to. Well, the problem is not finding the book; it's finding the proper thumb drive before I.
Okay, so I can't say anything. You'll be too fascinated; it'll distract you. So, okay, I'll say this. The failure of the McLuhan industry to, I can't remember what you said 15 minutes ago, maybe multiple perspectives or techniques to suspend a judgment or something. Does my pamphlet fall into the problems, the mistakes of the McLuhan school, or do you see I'm trying to do something that you would you require or say we haven't got to successfully yet?
Well, I think that I'm not sure that we entirely agree about McLuhan, but agreement isn't the point with McLuhan. If on any given quote, I think we probably both have interesting things to say.
Yeah.
But more important than that is that what you try to do especially in this book, but I think generally, what you try to do is you try to kind of apply McLuhan, and not only McLuhan, right? You probably think that Joyce is at least as important or more important than McLuhan. You try to apply these people to what you see going on around you in the world.
Yeah.
And you come up with interesting stuff. So to me, that's the single most important thing that McLuhan leads to. as you know, how to look at the world and how to understand it.
Right. Now, you were saying that the McLuhan industry, they try to go back to Gutenberg.
Absolutely.
Distill, yes. McLuhan. And so they missed the Marconi galaxy. They missed the multiple perspectives, basically?
Correct. But if we think of the Gutenberg galaxy and then the Marconi galaxy, McLuhan at his best emphasizes that we're always exposed to both.
Yeah.
And so individual experience can come out of one or the other or of both, but the theoretician of media needs constantly to bear in mind that there is this spectrum of figure and ground or eye and ear or Gutenberg and Marconi, and the theoretician not only needs to look at human experience in terms of that spectrum, but he or she needs to look from that spectrum.
From the spectrum. The Munsell sphere in Hot and Cool, where you the viewer is inside the Mobius strip or the circle or the sphere or the color spectrum.
Absolutely. And that's the phrase understanding media, which comes off people's lips so easily, means something like what we were just talking about. So something very much more complicated than some guy sitting in his well-appointed office, maybe with some research assistants hovering around, and they're going to understand media by thinking about TV or something.
Okay, what was that? My point there. The McLuhan. I think I was going to say that as you talk, I realize that's what I'm doing. What you're desiring to be done is what I've done here, and you even see it. You might see a linearity that isn't there as much as you think it's there. But there was another thought. So if McLuhan is using a multi-locational, what I call quadrophenia, that's because there's many forms that he can play with, so he juxtaposed the forms to forms. You know, my first early revelation about McLuhan was he wasn't just talking about what media do to me or people. It's what media do to other media. And then the more you understand that, you see that that's what McLuhan's talking about. That's why he doesn't have his private religion, private point of view, private stuff come in. He's studying the language of forms, but it's the language of the forms interplaying among themselves.
Correct.
And
correct.
a lot of people don't get to that point.
That's why talk about the spectrum is so important.
Yeah.
He says at one place that cliché can be isolated, but the archetype always retrieves all other archetypes.
Yeah.
Right? Why is that? It's because the archetype is naturally part of a spectrum. And no archetype can be called forth, if you will, without calling forth the whole spectrum.
That's right. He says in Take Today that Joyce understood that two words can evoke a whole universe, or maybe one word.
Absolutely. And let's look at the very first quotation that you have. On page one, the first lines of the preface say, the road to understanding media effects begins with arrogant superiority. Well, we were talking about flight. We were talking about how it's natural to human experience to have a vertical dimension to it that is usually completely unconscious.
Mm.
Right? And so here you are in the very first line. The road to understanding media effects begins with arrogant superiority. So that is exactly what taking flight is about, right?
Yeah.
Taking flight is absolutely necessary, and the interesting thing about this necessity is that it's always happening anyway.
Yeah.
It's just you don't know it's happening.
And you're quoting McLuhan. It's not what I'm writing in prose. It's the McLuhan quote.
It's what your quote, your very first quote
yeah.
from McLuhan. The road to understanding media effects begins with arrogant superiority. If one lacked this sense of superiority, this detachment, it would be quite impossible to write about them. It would be like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramids. So it's a great quotation, and the fact that you start with it is a very good sign for the book.
For the book, yeah, start off with the right
yeah.
foot.
Correct.
And then... Right. And then it goes,
Where nobody's hand has ever set foot.
Oh, yeah, where the hand of man never set foot. Which is what I tried to do here. Exactly.
Correct.
So this is an early quote, relatively earlier, and he's talking about media as people think media, you know, TV, thinking about TV. But then the next quote is at the end of his life. Or the life of utterance, and it's all about what's happening right then after Watergate and all the investigations of the intelligence of the CIA by the Frank Church Committee, you know, in American culture, all about espionage. So this quote is where we end, where McLuhan, the world that McLuhan maybe predicted, and now he's analyzing it, trying to get a perspective on it. So do you want to read that one?
Sure.
The, so this is the Alpha and the Omega.
Correct. Well, this is, we should note that the first quote, I think, is from the interview with Gerald Stern.
Yes.
And so that's in 67.
Yeah.
And this other interview is 78. So it's 10 years later. The 67, he's already written Understanding Media. He's already found Gestalt psychology,
yeah.
And he is in the process of thinking about how do I explain this stuff to people that don't want it explained to them, number one. And number two, what does it say about the coming world?
Yeah,
McLuhan's continual exercise of second sight, and what he does in that 10-year period is foresee a world that we 40 to 50 years later are currently living.
Yeah, an extremist. He wasn't extreme enough, but he was pretty extreme for his time. In what he says.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I would say that there are many things that McLuhan saw that we haven't really understood very well. So I don't think it's necessarily true that he didn't see how extreme things would get. In certain respects, he saw very clearly how extreme things would get. And we don't see how extreme they are.
Right. And I remember in 67 with the Twiggy phenomenon and whatever else was happening in pop culture, McLuhan says, I think it's the first time he says it, he says, we can expect more and more bizarre forms. So he predicted the extremeness that would come into, you know, Canadian-American life by saying it's going to get more and more bizarre. You remember that quote?
Yeah.
It was in a newspaper article.
I don't remember it, but it's, of course, it's you know, the sort of thing that he definitely would say. I think that that's something that he encountered very early on in his teaching that the students were coming from such strange presuppositions and assumptions that the old model of education just completely broke down.
Yeah. So, well, maybe I should read this.
Go ahead. Yeah, it's your quotation here.
Okay, so, and this is an unpublished interview with David Stone, who was an American, I don't know what he did, he was American, not a professor, I don't think, or anything, just a guy I liked to read McLuhan. And he would drop into the center and talk to McLuhan, you know, once a year or something. And he probably talked about McLuhan in his town, in the States where he's from. So he's an eccentric individual, not the usual type of people that McLuhan's being interviewed by, you know, the Robert Fulfords and that.
Right.
And it got unpublished. It didn't get published. Yeah, it got unpublished. So here's what McLuhan says to him. Pollster activities are all espionage, snooping on publics. The whole credit system is based on espionage. By the way, you can find out all the secret life of anybody by buying it from a crediting agency. It is a new kind of activity, and it may well undermine our political life because it has been discovered that in every single case of representatives in politics, there is a conflict of interest. You cannot be a representative of a big sector of the public without having conflicts of interest between your job and your role-playing and your private interests. And so the discovery of the conflict of interest, which is really the whole issue in Watergate, has in a sense overturned our political life. I know that right here in Canada, there's nobody in politics who doesn't have a conflict of interest. Remember, the politicians, they stand by their integrity. They don't have a conflict of interest, right? And McLuhan would say, you're all criminals. You all broke the law.
Right.
I know that right here in Canada, there's nobody in politics who doesn't have a conflict of interest. That would piss people off. That's the kind of stuff he'd say that he would make them no friends, right?
Well, the whole idea of cancel culture is the denial of that.
Yes. Okay, we'll go into that in a minute. I'll finish the quote. Many lawyers go into politics, and by definition, they have a conflict of interest. Any lawyer has a conflict of interest in politics. He's using his political position to obtain for himself new clients and new connections at all times. That's how he gets into politics in the first place. Okay, so I think that's a great quote. It shows McLuhan, you know, on the ground, watching what's happening around people. He's not trying to create a theory of consciousness. He's not even trying to create a tetrad. He's looking at the processes that are happening around him, you know, and noticing, wow, nobody has is free of a conflict of interest. Wow, that sort of makes law obsolete, or at least in that realm of politics. If everybody has a conflict of interest, first of all, how could that be? Then where is the integrity of the politician, if the politician is supposed to represent integrity, even though everybody knows he's the most or least integral person that comes into our face every day. So, and he said Watergate, the dirty underbelly of politics was given in the 20s and 30s and 40s. Everybody knew it was all, in that sense, corrupt. But it became showbiz with Watergate, meaning we had moved somewhere else. So there was no secrecy. So secrets and holding secrets became the new figure, the playground, or, you know, an art form.
Right.
So espionage takes over everything in entertainment, movies, politics, sports. Everything is espionage. And so that then kills the Mission Impossible or Spy versus Spy, those 60s, James Bond, those spy shows. Mm-hmm. So they were not reality. Well, okay, you take Dr. No. It's true that with decentralization, some guy who's got some new invention that he managed to make or steal, he can threaten the whole world, sort of like a chaos butterfly. That's part of the meaning of Dr. No, the boat, the present hijackers of the planet, but you have an old-fashioned individualist up against it, all by himself. You know, what McLuhan say, the detective versus the bureaucrat. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so these are some of the things. Now, did you start to say, you said something we might want to go back to.
What I want to do is note a couple things about these quotations. First off, it's a great introduction to your book, I think. We noted that the first quotation is 67, the second is 10 years later, and so that's a linear take on them.
Yeah.
But on your page, the 67 is above the 78, and not only is it above as a location, it's about being above. So
yeah.
It's about arrogant superiority and detachment, right?
Yes, yes.
And so the way that these quotations can be seen is that when one takes the arrogant superiority that the first quotation talks about and uses it to look at what's going on in American and Canadian politics and Canadian and American society and economy, then here's what you see, right? So there's a sense in which the 67 quotation is before the 78 one.
Yeah.
And this goes to your notion that, although I'm always harping on the chronological aspect of your thinking, at the same time, there's a contemporaneous aspect, all at once aspect, and that can be seen right here in the first page.
Excellent. Okay, I remember what you brought up, cancel culture. I'm going to try to think of it differently. So so this obsession, fetish for consensus, is that the word for what?
Yeah.
So this desire to have a uniformity naturally would come out of, make sense out of the chaos of social media. I mean, even Zuckerberg, they get investigated by Congress and they say, we don't know what's going on. We don't know who's in charge back at the headquarters, you know, which is going to lead to the end of the book. But the so canceling, is that a retrieval of American roots in Calvinism, in Puritanism?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So now they can't implement it completely because more and more people are rebelling, and you know, Donald Trump himself is going to try to provide an environment to outdo cancel culture with his new platform. You know, he's going to come up against it, try to make it go around it.
In a sense, Trump is what needs to be canceled.
Well, not for Americans when they want to see themselves in the mirror. And if they can't see that anymore, he's an archetype. That's why he was popular. He represented the, my friend calls it the fuck you thing, where you become so wealthy that you are the supreme lone ranger. Well, you're not a lone ranger. You're a godfather at first, and you are not subject to anybody's pressures because you got so much money and nobody can get to you. But then you want to turn it into a service environment, so you become the lone ranger trying to improve the world in some way, or improve America, or retrieve America. Mm. So he
right,
was,
but he's like Gulliver being tied down.
Yes.
Trump was able to do a few things as president, but most of the things that he talked about doing, he simply wasn't able to, either because he didn't understand politics or because there was too much power on the other side or because the issue was more complicated than he thought. But, I mean, just for example, he talked about releasing documents about the investigation of Russiagate. He talked about that for 4 years, and at the end, he wasn't able to do it.
Right.
He could not get the bureaucrats to move.
Right.
So it's an interesting phenomenon, actually.
Yeah, I just read about the Congress confirmed Biden's presidency on January 6th, and the very next day, the director of National Intelligence, Ratcliffe, released his long-awaited report, where he points out, the report does that Trump's suspicions are justified, but it's after Trump, and he explains that he couldn't release it earlier because it would appear to be interfering politically, so he kept it aside. But when it was irrelevant, wouldn't help Trump stay in office if it had come out a couple months earlier, and by justifying Trump, he releases it and it's obsolete. Now, on a content level, a gossipy level, what do you call when you're talking about the events of the day, which can be the ground, but we're now waiting for the Durham report. And there's a commercial out where Durham says that he's a tough guy and this ain't going to be no pussy capitulation. So we'll see. You see if that
yeah,
happens.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, no.
I couldn't tell when I saw it whether the commercial was a put on or not. It might have been done by Saturday Night Live or something, but it seemed to have him on in there talking. So another confusing bit of data thrown at me because I made the mistake of looking at the Android meme. Right? The goal today is to be uninformed, or at least on the content level, to study the language of form.
Remember, that's exactly what the Romantics were doing. Right? They wanted to be uninformed about the other moments.
That's right.
They wanted to be uninformed about other points of view.
And by avoiding people.
That's right, by going out to be alone. Right?
Yeah.
So we're circling around the same ideas all the time, and I think we're doing it in a way that is interesting and helpful, but we're also showing how central these things were to McLuhan and are to contemporary history.
Yeah, and can be equal to your notion of the periodic table. He's come up with the new media elements, the basic elements of experience today.
Yeah.
Yeah, now the, what else about that? What did you just say before getting into going out to be alone? You cited something. I was saying, citing the Durham report.
I was saying it was going back, well, I didn't relate to the Durham report, although I believe that nothing is going to come of that myself. But,
oh, that's what I wanted to talk about. The language of forms and media affecting media, I call it the media environments are etherealized to the point of being memes. What is the ground today? Now, my book tries to point out what the ground is, but we're not going to say what it is. But I'm just asking you, what do you think with all media canceling out each other, then where are we and what is the medium? If you got a way to answer that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't know if answer is a description, but I can certainly discuss it. If we think of human experience as a constant taking flight above the possibilities of experience, the spectrum of experience, and the especially in America, the need is to forget this hovering over the possibilities and to make concrete some particular identity. So the great problem in the United States is that what is attempted is not even possible. That the very attempt has already got cracks and difficulties in it, and there's only two possible responses. You can make it more and more and more concrete. And by concrete, I don't mean the opposite to fluid. I mean concrete in the sense of a material. Concrete that is used to build a building, concrete that is used to make something stable as a foundation. So the American experience is adding more and more and more concrete to an unstable situation, and when that finally breaks, we're going to have a huge problem. So
that's the Joni Mitchell song. Put up another parking lot or something?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, take paradise and put a parking lot over it.
Tear down a great old building and put up a parking lot.
Yeah. So, did you finish your point?
Well, I'm not. I don't think so. To discuss your point, but you go ahead. You lead on.
Well, they used to say the East was inscrutable when Westerners traveled to the Asia or the Orient. I don't think you use that word anymore. To non-industrialized cultures, tribal places, they'd encounter the inscrutable East. I always thought it was neat that McLuhan said in the global theater, America became the inscrutable and became the inscrutable American, the ugly American, or the inscrutable West. There's a cliche about the inscrutable East that people might have heard. You can't count on people, young people, knowing this stuff now. You know, I encountered a young person. He was reading McLuhan, and he says, "What's nationalism?"
Right.
You know, it's probably surprising what the gaps are in their knowledge. So, but the inscrutable East was a cliche way back there. And so I thought that was pretty original. Come up with the inscrutable West is what we are, because as the global theater took over and the less developed cultures in the second world, the third world, and the Aboriginal fourth world were collective, tribal, oral, tactile. America's kinetic visual bias was becoming more and more alien to everybody, and so Trump retrieves that alien aspect of the American individual, American archetype, and becomes the most horrified, threatening phenomenon since Hitler. He actually was just retrieving what the inscrutable America was.
Correct. I think that's an excellent insight, actually. If we think about this need to be number one, this need to go out and be alone, what's happening there is a divorce between individual identity and the possibilities of identity. The possibilities of identity are inherently plural, are inherently gapped, and are inherently dynamic. So what was inscrutable about the East is that you could go there and you could say, in Japan, let's say, well, how many people... what percentage of the population is Buddhist? And the answer would be, well, it's 78%. Hmm. And then you'd say, well, what percentage of the population is Shinto? And then they would say, oh, that's 83%. And a Western mind could not understand how people could have multiple religions.
Right, right.
Right? They couldn't possibly understand that. So now the ugly American is the American that actually exposes this multiplicity behind the mask.
Yeah.
Right? The American is somebody who's supposed to be smiling, in charge of things, the good manager, leave it up to me to govern the world and all will be well. And below that is extreme instability. And we're now living in a time where that gap, which is very, very explosive, there's a lot of power in that gap, is growing wider and wider and wider, and nobody knows what's going to happen. And I think you're right that Trump is a kind of signal of that growing gap.
Yeah.
It's like a fault in the earth, the San Andreas Fault, that is opening and opening and opening, and everybody knows that the end is not good. But
yeah.
They hope it happens after they're gone.
Yeah. Now, do you have a McLuhan take on the Biden image yet?
Well, what would I say about that? I mean, Biden is the sort of the idol of culture, of cancel culture.
Yeah.
Biden is that person that you're not allowed to have various views on. He just represents the unmitigated
nobody.
Good. Yeah, that's right. In order to be the representative of cancel culture, you can't be anyone in particular.
Right, and remember McLuhan's quote from 72, and take today, the automated presidential surrogate is a superlative nobody.
Yeah.
So Trump violated that. He was a somebody because he came from what, you know, that other world, business, you know. So that archetype,
right.
He was an invasion.
Well, it's not only business. It's the major thing wrong with Trump is that he's not well-spoken. He's extremely egotistical. He's not well-mannered. He doesn't give a shit about other people. he represents an extreme threat to the self-identity of Americans,
or at least
of some Americans.
I can see soccer moms having a real problem letting their kids know of this guy's existence, because the whole
Correct.
Thing about growing up and being educated is they have a go towards a refined sophistication that the president's supposed to represent, you know,
That's right.
the benefits of
That's right.
Of intelligence. And you got a porn star.
He's the grab the pussy guy.
Yeah, you got a porn star as president. I mean, how outrageous is this? It's amazing. Well, maybe they tried to assassinate him, but it's amazing he survived all these years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Kennedy was a threat. He was a powerful TV image, which threatened Big Brother. So they had to get rid of his image. And I was just reading an article.
Kennedy knew something about politics. So he may have represented at the level of administration, at the level of law, at the level of leverage in Washington. Kennedy may have been more of a threat. This guy, Trump, sort of came out of left field, and I think the bureaucrats, especially in the Pentagon, realized early on that he simply didn't know where the levers were.
Right.
So how could he actually pilot the plane?
Right. So I was just thinking that Kennedy was the last perfect president for the liberal dream. So there never was a charismatic president after him until maybe Reagan, but that might have been more imposed on people, forced by the android meme, because there were so many bad presidents, they had to come up with some kind of retrieval of small town America and decency. But then, you know, has there been anybody since Reagan? No. And then Obama was another kind of charisma, and then there's no more president possible. So anybody can take over. Do you see people? Do you know that?
Takeover is a bad word.
Yeah, I know. Well, they get
anybody could
buried.
Be taken over.
Yeah. So many candidates want to get buried. You know that Meghan Markle, or whatever her name is, Prince Harry's wife?
Yeah, I know who she is.
Yeah, she recently is exploring about running for president because she had a good Oprah show. That's a sign of intelligence, sophistication. But it shows you how obsolete. You know, McLuhan would have to update that. There used to be an automated presidential surrogate, but too many nobodies applied for the job.
That's very, very funny.
Yeah, we have a pattern there. We can sell that one.
That's right. But listen, Bob, we're...
Yep. I can't hear you.
720 around, right?
I thought I couldn't hear you. Okay, you're there. So you think we've done two quotes. What would you say next? You don't have to go into it because we'll do it next week, but what would be your next point of interest in the beginning here? The cul-de-sac? But we did the cul-de-sac. Took 19 shows.
Well, we've sort of, but I think we can take it up again in terms of your first two quotes.
Okay.
In terms of what we've been talking about. So what we can do is put a bow on our discussion of the cul-de-sac and then move on from there into trying to get into your book.
Okay. You're a little burbly, but I think we heard everything you said. So we're finished for today. Thanks a lot.
Sir.
Thanks a lot, Cameron.
Thank you, Bob. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was really good. Thanks for your contributions.
Well, I'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Okay, then. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Yep.